If you knew you were going on a trip, a long trip, you were going to be gone for a while, or even if you were moving out of the area, and you knew that you were kind of, this is it, this is your last day here, what would you do? What would you do?
Tasty tacos.
Tasty tacos. Look you there. There's a fan right there. Look at that. Getting some tasty tacos because this is the only place you can get them, right? Exactly.
Not open on Sunday,
and not open on Sunday. Man, just like Chick-fil-A. What else would you do? Anybody else? What would you do? Go out for drinks. What was that?
Clean
something. There are a few in the room that might agree with that. So, hang out with a bunch of friends. Would you have anything to share with people? Like, would you make a big speech or would you just like, let's go have fun? Maybe just go have fun. Just let your hair down. Who would you spend it with? You said friends. Who would you take to Tasty Tacos?
I take my friends there and two birds with one stone.
Okay, nice. Yes. Anybody else? Let's say your family wasn't going with you. Family being that, wouldn't they? I didn't tell you that ahead of time. I should have. I thought about this. I thought about, all right, especially, you know, if I was going away and I couldn't come back or I wasn't going to be back for a bit, what would I say? What would I do? Who would I share with? And I thought, you know what? I'm assuming I can't take my wife and kids with me. I'm assuming that this is me leaving. Sorry, Liz, you just get left behind. I'd start with my wife and kids. And I thought, you know what? I would start with Carrie and I would tell her how much I loved her, obviously. I would also talk to her about how much better my life was with her than it would have been without. And then I would probably try to remind her with pictures a lot of the crazy times that we've spent together, especially those moments where all she wanted was a serious picture of us as a couple, and I just refused. You know, a face, whatever, you know, that I would spend some time. And I think there'd be a lot of laughter with that. I'd tell my kids how proud I am of them. I don't think we tell our kids that maybe enough. I'd tell them how proud I am of, and I'd probably tell them I'm sorry. There's nothing more humbling than being a parent. Can all the parents say amen? I mean, nothing makes you look back and go, wow, I really screwed that up. But then I would tell them how proud I am of them and just kind of, you know, spend time hanging out there. Then I thought about you guys. I know, weird, right? This coming July will be my 18th anniversary here. I've never been 18 years anywhere in my life. This is by far the most time I've spent anywhere. But I thought, you know, 18 years with you guys, the only other relationships I have quite as long, I guess, my older five kids, the other two, they're too young to remember. My wife and my immediate family. You guys are like the longest relationships I've ever had. And I think I would say to you guys, I would say thank you for putting your trust in me to be your pastor, for allowing me to follow God wherever it led, even when it didn't necessarily look like what maybe church growth or church life should look like. I thank you for the freedom that we've had to focus on things that maybe aren't typical for churches to focus on. We don't have to focus on numbers. We don't have to do all the typical, like I said, church growth stuff. And I would say thank you for your openness to God, for just a willingness to be here and share with one another and just together say, huh, there's Jesus, let's walk that way. And I would hope as I left, you would remember my quirkiness, not necessarily my moments of explosive anger, Amy, but hopefully above all would be how much I love Jesus. Now, I'm not going anywhere. At least I don't think I am. Yeah. But I thought about those things and I thought, you know, these are the things that are really important. I hope that the impact I leave is really, he was a weird dude, but man, he loved Jesus, because I really do. You know, there's not many things as sobering as thinking about that question, is there? I mean, it's kind of a down question. What do you say to people if you were going to leave? If you had one last message to give, what would you do? That's a very sobering thing. And even when we think of our own mortality, that really brings things into focus. But what we do, I think, is when we think about that, we think about what's most important. What are the things that I feel like need to be said, need to be shared above all else? And I think we become very focused in that time. Well, today we're starting a brand new series that we're calling Before I Go. And it's not Before I Go, but it's going to be looking at Jesus, specifically what he did and what he said at the end of the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John has it recorded for us. It's these final hours kind of after the Last Supper when he's talking to his disciples. We get insight into some things he prayed, and then right before his arrest. And so we're going to be here until Easter, kind of leading us up there, and we'll deal with the arrest on Good Friday and all that kind of stuff. But I want us to look at what did Jesus think was important before he left, before he went, before he was crucified. So as we jump in here, this is going to be a little different than where we've been series-wise. We're just going to be walking, marching right through the Gospel of John, chapters 14 through 17 for several weeks. It's going to be good. We're going to dive in. But to set us up today, we've got to get a little background because chapter 14 doesn't just happen in a vacuum. There's chapter 13 right before it. And chapter 13 is really cool because that's where we find Jesus. And he's with his disciples and they're in the upper room and they do have the Last Supper. And Jesus, there's this moment where if you haven't read it in a while, you really should go read John 13 because at the beginning of that, Jesus is there. They've come into this room. They're going to share this meal together. And Jesus does something really scandalous. He walks over and he picks up a towel and he picks up a basin and he gets some water. And as his disciples are just sitting around the table and they're chatting with one another, Jesus does what typically only a slave would do. Only the lowliest of the lowly would do. And one by one, he goes to each of his disciples and he washes their feet. And he has these interesting interactions. I mean, with Peter, Peter's like, oh, no, no, Jesus, you're not washing my feet. And Jesus is like, Peter, calm down. I need to wash your feet. And Peter's like, no, then wash all of me. And it's Jesus like, again, Peter, calm down. You only need your feet washed. That's it. But when you think about who all's at the table, it's not just Peter who's willing to question. It's Thomas who's going to doubt later. It's Judas who, at the end of chapter 13, we see Jesus even sends him off and says, you know what you've got to do. Go do it. And so Judas leaves and goes to betray him. He heads out and he sells Jesus out for 30 pieces of silver. He leads them to him a little bit later in the garden and even betrays him with a kiss when he sees Jesus. Jesus, in this moment, tells his disciples, I'm leaving. I'm going away. And he look at what he says. This is chapter 13. Jesus said, now the Son of Man is glorified and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself and glorify him at once. My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I'm going, you cannot come. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. Can you imagine sitting at this table, listening to Jesus, and hold on, you're leaving? What are you doing? Now, this isn't the first time Jesus has said this. If you go back and look at Jesus' interactions, he's telling them this. He's preparing them. He's setting this up. But they still don't get it. They still don't understand. And in fact, Peter, you know, the guy who always speaks his mind, even often before thinking, he comes out, comes to Jesus and he says, Jesus, whatever you're talking about, I'm with you. I'll lay down my life for you. You're not going to do this alone. And Jesus looks at Peter and he says, will you really lay down your life for me? Very truly, I tell you, before the rooster crows, you'll disown me three times. Just let that sit for a moment. The seriousness of that moment. The guy you've been following for 3 years, the man that you look up to, the man that you've seen do miracles, looks you in the face and says, you have lofty, lofty dreams, Peter. And I appreciate that, but before the morning comes, you're gonna deny me. You're gonna deny that you even know me three times. If you put yourself in that moment, put yourself at that table, what's the feeling in that room? What are you feeling? Pit in your stomach. Is this real? Mm-hmm. Are we defensive? Yeah. Sobering. I felt tension. Oh, I don't, nobody, who likes conflict? Who are my conflict lovers? Anybody? Okay, most of us don't like conflict. How many of us in this moment would just be like, there's a corner. I'm just going to go stand in the corner of the room. You guys do that. And I'm just, it's just tense. And there's confusion. And you're just thinking, what is going on here? I mean, to the people, to these folks who had left everything to follow Jesus, to hear he's about to leave, this is going to be very concerning. It's going to be earth-shattering even as you listen to this, and your mind is probably going a million miles a minute just trying to piece this together. What is he talking about? Well, it doesn't get any easier, I don't think. Let's keep reading as we start in John chapter 14, where Jesus says, "Do not let your hearts be troubled." Oh, so we get an indication here that everything we just kind of looked at, that pit in your stomach, the confusion, the tension, that's real. Otherwise, why would Jesus say what he did? "Do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I'm going to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I'm going." Thomas said to him, "Lord, we don't know where you are going, so how can we know the way?" It's a good question, by the way. Jesus answered, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really know me, you will know the Father as well. From now on, you do know him and you've seen him." It's kind of interesting, isn't it, that after all that's been said, he calls out Judas for the betrayal. He calls out Peter for denial. He calls out, you know, to the disciples, "Hey, I'm leaving." And then in this moment, Jesus looks at them and he says, "But hey, don't be troubled." Now that seems a little flippant, doesn't it, if we're honest? Like, hold on, everything you've just told me, oh, sure, Jesus, no trouble at all. Don't be agitated. That's what it means. Don't be fearful. That pit in your stomach, remove that. Let me ask you, how's that work out for you? Not so well, right? And as Jesus says, "Don't be troubled," we need to hear there's a forcefulness behind this. This isn't just a sheepish kind of, "Well, you know, guys, I'm sorry, don't be troubled." No, there's a real power. Don't be troubled. But even in that power, they're spoken with gentleness. There's a gentleness in his word. It's as if Jesus is saying to them, "You know what, guys? It may look like your world is falling apart. It may look like all is lost, that the darkness is about to overwhelm you. And I know that in this moment right now, you're questioning, there's confusion, and you're thinking, your hearts are so anxious. You're so confused. But let's stop right there. You don't have to be anxious. You don't have to be fearful. You don't have to be troubled." Why would Jesus say that? What's amazing to me in this moment is that Jesus was not ignorant of the things that were about to happen to him. He knew in just a few short hours he would be arrested. He would be beaten. He would be tried. He would be convicted. And in under 24 hours, he would be nailed to a Roman cross and crucified. So let's stop for a moment and let's put ourselves in Jesus' shoes. How do you think Jesus is doing? Where do you think Jesus' heart and emotions and mind and soul are? You think he might be stirred up a little bit? You think he might have a little bit going on within? And yet in this moment, with all that he's facing, what is his concern? His concern is for them. "Hey guys, don't let your heart be troubled." And he actually tells them, gives them some guidance on how, because we know we can't just will our way out of anxiousness. "Oh, don't be anxious, don't be." No, it doesn't work, does it? So he gives us some guidance on how to move our hearts from anxiousness to assurance, to move our hearts from panic to peace. Because he said, "Don't let your hearts be troubled." He said, "You believe in God, believe also in me." As one commentary I read this week put it, they said, the answer to trouble is trust. Jesus is talking to them about focus, about what they're focusing on in this moment, what's got their attention. And he's saying to them, "You know what? It's about to get rough. It's about to get difficult. It's about to get overwhelming. Yes, I'm not going to deny that. I'm not saying, oh, no, it'll be easy. No, this is going to suck. It really is. But what I'm telling you guys is let's shift our eyes. Don't look at that. Look at me. Look at me. I've shown you. I've walked with you. I've modeled for you. You've got a choice. Where are you going to put your eyes? I get it. To hear, you know, the answer to trouble is trust. Put it on a pillow, right? I mean, that is one of those good Christian platitudes. Put it in a fortune cookie, you know. And as I read stuff like that, I often even look at it and I go, is there any depth to that? And there is depth to it in this. What are we focused on? And what that object that we're called to trust in, can it support our trust? Can it carry the weight that we are putting on it? And if Jesus had said, you know what, that pastor you've got in 2025, Brent, trust in him. I'm going to tell you what, you're in trouble. I can't bear that weight. But Jesus doesn't say don't trust in the religious system. He doesn't say trust in yourself. He doesn't say trust even just in the good things that happen to you. What's he say? He says trust in me. Because he is the object that is worthy, that can stand up, and he can handle our anxiousness. He can handle our panic. He can handle all these things. And what we see here in this moment by Jesus making this statement, this isn't just a flippant thing. Oh, trust me. No, there's a real boldness to this statement. And you'll see in a moment, he's going to even get bolder. But in this moment right here, when he says, you see God, you trust in God, you can trust in me. What is he doing right there? He's putting himself on that same level with God. He's saying, I'm not just anybody. I am God. And what he's trying to do is to continue to remove any doubt about who he is. He is God, equal with God. I mean, the Gospel of John has been laying this foundation from the beginning. John 1:1, John wrote these words. He said, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the same was in the beginning with God, and through him all things were made, and without him nothing was made that has been made. John is saying, look, I want you to see not just this human side of Jesus. I want you to see the divine side of Jesus. Amen. We believe in Trinity. There's God the Father, God the Spirit. And Jesus is saying, I am God the Son. This is his divine nature. We call this a high Christology, looking at who his divine nature. And he's going to make this even clearer in a moment. And Jesus says, hey, guys, I know this is disturbing. But you've already been trusting in God. These past 3 years, you've seen me do some things. Keep trusting in me. That's where it begins. This is going to be confusing. It's going to be anxious. We can get through this. Trust in me. And then he moves on to something else. Something that I think in the Christian world, we love to take and just run with and speculate on. And unfortunately, I think we like to make this next part the point of the passage, but it's not. He says this. He says, in my Father's house are many rooms. So let's talk about heaven. Everybody likes to talk about heaven, right? The good old King James that I grew up with, you know what the word was there instead of rooms? Mansions. In my Father's house are many mansions. Oh my goodness. It's like Jesus is Oprah. You get a mansion and you get a mansion and you get a mansion and you get, you know. No. Growing up, there were hymns that we sang that talked about this. I've Got a Mansion was one. I mean, I think even Hank Williams sang the song, Lord, build me a cabin in the corner of glory land. Is that what Jesus is talking about? No. Now, I have to be careful here. I was talking with a friend this week. He said, Brent, I think you kind of have a low view of heaven. Maybe. Or maybe I just have a higher view of Jesus. What is Jesus talking about here? Look at what I think the point is he's trying to make. He's really not describing a place, is he? He says, oh, I'm going to a place, rooms, okay. But we don't get streets of gold and pearly gates from here, do we? Jesus is telling us he's got something to do to prepare for us. And he's not saying I got to run down to Home Depot and pick up some 2x4s and nails and then I'll get started on it. What he's doing by this is he's saying, look, the preparation is about to be done. The preparation is going to be in my death and my resurrection. So we don't need to have this image of Jesus right now hammering, I've almost got Tim's room done. You know, praise God, right, Tim? No, the place is going to be prepared as soon as he dies on the cross. They place his body in the grave and he rises from the dead. That's already done. The place is done. It's already. But let's think about the place because we like to focus on the place. Rooms here, in this passage here, is the Greek word mone. Kind of like money, but mone. And it's only used twice in the New Testament at all. This part here where we get rooms, but then the second one's a little later in chapter 14. And we'll just look at this verse because Jesus says, anyone who loves me will obey my teaching. My Father will love them and he will come to live with them and make our home with them. See that word home? That's the same word. What's the point of that word? Is it about a dwelling? Is it about a structure? You know, is it about 3 bedrooms, 2 baths with, you know, 1,700 square feet on a nice cul-de-sac? No, it's not. It's not about the building. What Jesus is talking about is the relationship. He's talking about the who, because it's more, focus on the prepositions of both of these passages. He says, I'm getting a room, who? For you. He says, God will make his home with them. That's all about the relationship. We being in relationship, in existence, in the same place with God. One commentary put it this way. It said, when we unpack the metaphor here, we should not think so much of rooms as in God's house, much less the mansions of the King James Version, but of the privilege of abiding in God's presence. That's what he's talking about. That's the goal, not some mansion, God's presence. And I think we can get this so wrong, and I think it shows how little we think of God, what God is offering. Because for so long, the Christian church has made the end goal heaven as if that's the prize. And as if Jesus is the consolation prize. Jesus is not now nor ever been the consolation prize. He is the prize. Heaven is just the place we get to interact with him in his presence forever. He is the greatest. Jesus is the greatest gift that we could ever get. All the other images, the possibilities of heaven can't hold a candle to the presence of God. That's it. That's the goal. And Jesus, he's articulating this when he says in his best Terminator voice, I'll be back. That's what he's saying. He's saying, look, I got stuff to do. What's preparing this place? I got to go be killed. I'm going to be buried, but I'm going to rise again. That's going to prepare the place. And don't worry, there'll be a time when we will all be together because you'll be with me. And really, does the place even matter if we're with Jesus? Does the place even matter if we get to be with Jesus? No. In fact, I would make the case every place is heaven if Jesus is there. Jesus in this moment, this is one of 318 references or allusions that he made, that he's coming back to take us with him. And again, the goal here isn't scaring you. The goal here isn't tempting you with a carrot of streets of gold. The prize itself, then and now, has always been Jesus Christ himself. Now, like many of us, at least me, in this moment, I would have probably spoken up like Thomas. It's a good question, right? How can we know how to get there if we don't know where you're going? And Jesus' response, oh, you know the way. How could we possibly? And then Jesus says, you know the way. And what the disciples hear is, I've given you a map. I've given you a map. So get in your car and leave the parking lot. And I want you to go out to Ashworth and go east on Ashworth and then go north on 50th and then get on 235. How many of us hear that as well? We want a map. We want the way. We want it drawn out for us. But again, let's picture ourselves in this moment. The disciples are already uptight. Jesus is talking about leaving, and they're thinking, well, where does that leave us? And Jesus says, oh, I'm going home. And it's like, well, you going to Mary's house? Going to Mary Martha's house with Lazarus? What are you talking about? Where are you going? And then Jesus reemphasizes the point about this isn't about the place. It's about being with me. Because then he makes this incredible statement that I think is very problematic for many people today. Because Jesus says, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. And again, he moves that conversation from the place to the person. It's not about the room, it's about the relationship. And this is the passage that gets us in trouble. Because this is where, when you live in a pluralistic culture, that we hear something like this. Jesus said, no one comes to the Father but through me. And our pluralistic culture says, you guys are so exclusivist. You're so arrogant. Who do you think you are? Who do you think you are to say that there's only one way to be right with God? But we have to ask the question, can there be an inclusive theology where everyone is right? Can every religion lead us to God? Can they all be true? And unfortunately, the answer is no. If everything is true, nothing is true. No one who genuinely holds to their belief system would agree with the claim that everyone can be right at the same time. All the major world religions claim exclusivity at some level. And it really isn't arrogance. It is someone who has examined the claims and believe they contain the truth. So while some look at this statement that Jesus makes and says, oh, it's so incredibly intolerant, so is the claim that people make that all roads will get you to God. That's just as exclusive and intolerant. And while sounding incredibly enlightened and open-minded, these inclusive claims are nothing more than just as exclusive claims as Jesus made with his disciples. There's all exclusive claims. It's just we have to take the one that Jesus made and say, what am I going to do with that one? As I said, Jesus follows up the statement. He says, no one comes to the Father but through me. And this isn't the only time we see this statement. In fact, the disciples must have believed it, held on to it, because just a little bit later in the gospel, in the book of Acts, we find Peter preaching, Acts 4:12, and he says, salvation is found in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given to mankind by which we must be saved. There's an exclusivity here. There's a line in the sand. And that line says, what are we going to do with Jesus? And we consider the source of this statement, I am the way, the truth, and the life. It's made by one who's claiming himself to be God. One commentary I read this week put it this way. It said, at a time when religious pluralism and syncretism are widespread, such claims are never going to be popular. Nothing less, however, is the implication of Jesus' incarnation. If in Jesus God has come among us in person to reconcile his rebellious lost world, it follows necessarily that through him and him alone is the way to God. The exclusiveness of Christ's salvation is simply the uniqueness of his divine person. He is making claims that no one else does. And in saying he is the way, Jesus says, this future I'm telling you about can only happen through me. It doesn't even happen through the Bible. It doesn't happen through church attendance. It happens only through Jesus. He isn't a guide at the trailhead saying, go this way. He's saying, I am the way. It comes through me. A quote I read one some time ago said, Jesus is not a path. We set out into the universe to go find God. Jesus is the way God has come to find us. And that's what we have to realize. And I've said it before, I'll say it again, and it's all about relationship. And that's a challenge, because it would be so much easier if this religious thing was just nothing more than a checklist. Go to church, check, read my Bible a couple times a week, check, pray occasionally, check. Checklists are easy. Relationships are complicated. Can I get an amen from the married people in the room? And Jesus says, you know the way because you know me. You've seen me. You've walked with me. We aren't forced to find our own way using our own resources, our own goodness, our own knowledge. He isn't pointing the way. He is the way. He isn't teaching the truth. He is the truth. He isn't the one way. He isn't one way to life. He is the life. Our search for meaning, for purpose, our desire for more, our quest for God begins and ends with Jesus. And as N.T. Wright, I love him, he wrote this. He said, if you dethrone Jesus, you enthrone something else or someone else instead. The belief that all religions are really the same sounds nice and democratic, though the study of religions quickly shows that this isn't true. What you're really saying, if you claim that they are all the same, is that none of them are more than distant echoes, distorted images of reality. You're saying that reality, God, the divine, is remote and unknowable, and that neither Jesus nor Buddha nor Moses nor Krishna gives us direct access to it. They all provide a way to the foothill of the mountain, but not the way to the summit. I want the summit with Jesus. This is powerful stuff that Jesus is saying here. And I think there's a few things we take away from this passage today. And it just begins with the same thing Jesus began with in John 14. Is your heart troubled? Are you sitting here today with kind of a troubled heart and soul? Have you asked the question, why? Why is your heart troubled? Is it because you've placed that trust, that faith in something that can't support it? Something unworthy of your trust, like the idols we've been talking about the last several weeks in the last series, success, money, even politics? Or maybe you sit here and you think, well, my heart isn't troubled. Why have you placed your trust in Jesus? Because I think we can just as easily be untroubled, but have our faith and our confidence in the wrong thing. Second thing I want to ask you is this: how do you see Jesus? Is he your consolation prize? Is he a necessary annoyance as you wait for that ride to heaven? If Jesus is nothing but your ticket to heaven, you might not be following the right Jesus. Look again at what Jesus is offering. Do you feel lost? You feel like you've tried different paths only to be left wanting again and again? Jesus is saying to you this morning, I am the way. Are you searching for meaning in life? Realizing that all the way the world tells you, it leaves you feeling empty. Jesus is saying to you, I am the life. Are you searching after half-truths or tired of just being filled with lies? Jesus is saying to you, I am the truth. Are you ready to surrender to Jesus, to look to him and say, Jesus, you are my way. You are my truth. You are my life. There's a quote I read this week from Thomas A. Kempis in his book, The Imitation of Christ. He writes this: follow me. I am the way and the truth and the life. Without the way, there is no going. Without the truth, there is no knowing. Without the life, there is no living. I am the way which you must follow, the truth which you must believe, and the life for which you must hope. I am the unshakable way, the infallible truth, and the never-ending life.